podcast, Wednesday, May 1st, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be sitting down here with you once again, going over the latest in Apple news, Mac news, iOS and iPad, iPhone news, all of those things we have to talk about in this episode, including Apple's latest quarterly results, which, depending upon your perspective, are a little bit of a mixed bag. So we've got some good stuff and bad stuff in there, some ups and downs. We have WWDC to talk about, which is coming up soon. Apple put the tickets on sale, and they once again sold out in record time. We have new Apple products to talk about, including MacBooks, and we need to discuss what's happening with iOS 7, macOS 10, 10.9, all that future stuff to get into. And we also have your feedback, some tips and tricks, and a bunch of other goodies. But before we get into that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that is ShareFile by Citrix. I really want you to go take a look at ShareFile because it's not like a lot of the other file sharing services that you're used to. What it comes down to is when we're working, it makes a difference how we work, how we get things done, and efficiency is really important. You need tools that are easy to use and aren't going to waste a lot of time and energy. And when it comes to things like sharing documents, this is critical. You need certain files to get your job done, and you can't have inefficiencies with how you receive those documents. You need to be able to track those sorts of files, know that they're getting to the people that you need them to get to, know that maybe they opened that file, that they received the file, and ShareFile can address a lot of these things. It's designed to be collaborative. It's designed to be a tool that makes more efficient use of your time. If you've used traditional methods in the past, a lot of us use things like email for sending files back and forth. Well, often clients will try to send you a file that's too large, it bounces, they don't know if you got it, you received it or not, maybe you send something back, it can be a hassle. And you try to do workarounds, maybe use FTP servers. Those are complex, and a lot of clients don't understand that. ShareFile is designed to be easy to use and to be able to send documents and files of almost any size securely and simply. All you do is send an email and you send a link, and then the person goes to your ShareFile. And that whole experience can be branded to your business. This is something that's really important for someone like me. I run my own business, I do web development, and I very often need to share files with clients, but I don't want to have them go through an elaborate process just to be able to upload me a file. With ShareFile, I can send them a link, they can go to a site that's branded to my business, and through their web browser, upload a file to me. And then that file shows up in my share file. I can set up project folders. I can set up client folders. If it's a larger project and I want to bring the client in, I can invite them into the share file. And we can set up a whole syncing scenario so that when they put a document in the share file, I receive it and vice versa. And all of that is handled securely, so I don't have to worry about it. And if I do need help, I get tech support. I get a dedicated account manager, someone that's going to help me set it all up, make sure it's running properly, and it could not be easier. If you've ever had troubles sending and sharing files with colleagues, with customers, with clients, I think you need to give ShareFile a try. It can literally change the way you work. So to help you get started, I have a special 30-day free trial offer. There's no obligation, and you'll be able to see the difference right away. To take advantage of the offer, just go to ShareFile.com today, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter the promo code MACCAST. That's ShareFile.com, and type in my code MACCAST. And a big thank you to Citrix and ShareFile for their support of the MACCAST. So Apple's latest quarterly results are in, and the numbers are very good in one respect and a little bit down in another respect. I don't want to say that, you know, they're bad, because I personally don't think that they are, but some analysts, some watchers think that one of the stats is an area for concern. So let's go over the numbers real quick. Apple reported $43.6 billion in revenue and net profit of $9.5 billion. And the reason the news was mixed was because Apple had a revenue increase of 11%, but their net profit was actually down 18% from 11.6% last year. And this was the first profit loss for Apple in the last 10 years. But despite that, they did still manage to ship 37.4 million iPhones, 19.5 million iPads, 5.6 million iPods, and just under 3.9 million Macs. So Mac sales overall were down about 2% year over year, but as Apple's CFO Peter Oppenheimer pointed out, that drop is significantly lower than the overall drop or decline in PC sales, according to the latest IDC numbers, which was 14%. So Apple doing better on average than their competitors, at least when it comes to selling PCs. An even more positive result was that despite selling fewer Macs for the quarter, revenue on those sales was actually up. Apple earned $5.45 billion in Mac sales versus $5.07 billion for the same period last year. Now, a big reason for the slide in Apple's profit is likely due to reduced profit margins on profits, things like the iPad mini, which has a lower profit margin built into it. They're also selling a lot of older reduced priced devices like the iPhone 4S and the iPhone 4, especially in some more price sensitive markets. As a matter of fact, during the Q&A session, Tim Cook did cite the fact that he felt iPad cannibalization, or that iPads were cannibalizing at least some Mac sales, and that iPads are causing some people to extend their upgrade cycle, but he felt overall that that was more of a factor on the PC side than on the Mac side. But no matter the reason, the numbers don't lie. Apple reported that gross margins for the quarter were 37.5%. That's compared to 47.4% in the year ago quarter. So no doubt that reduced margins are having an impact on that net profit number. And as I was saying earlier, the iPad mini could be contributing to that. We've talked many times about the fact that Apple, that's a product that Apple makes that has their one of their lowest profit margins built into it. And according to DigiTimes, they estimate that about 64% of all iPads that were shipped during the quarter were actually the iPad minis. Some other highlights from the call: Tim Cook said that their teams were hard at work at some amazing new hardware, software, and services products, and that they can't wait to introduce them in the fall and throughout 2014. That was a little bit of a shocker, so it makes it seem like Apple might actually be backweighting their product releases toward the end of the year. It's not really clear why they would be doing that, if it's just simply delays and things that we've been hearing about in terms of stuff running behind schedule. Is it the kind of thing where Apple doesn't feel like there's a lot of threat from the competition and they can take a little bit more time to actually get the products right, to sort of finish things off? Is it that they want to have more new products in the lineup for the heavy back to school and holiday buying seasons? They don't really say why, but either way, for us Apple fans, it looks like we're going to be waiting a little while for future products and updates to come from Apple. It sounds like most of the stuff's going to be coming in the back half of the year. We'd already been kind of hearing that the iPhone and iPad updates are expected to arrive in the fall, although, as you'll hear in a little bit, some are still predicting that there might be some announcements related to that at WWDC in June. There was also that specific mention of services, and many people think that may indicate something like the rumored iTunes Music streaming service is still yet to come, at least this year. Cook also stressed that the Mac market was still important to Apple and said that Apple would continue to innovate on the Mac side and that they still ultimately see tablet growth as something that will help the Mac, not necessarily hinder it. I'm kind of reading into that, that what Cook means is that the halo effect that the iPad is having on Windows and PC users, that gets them in the door, gets them familiar with Apple's products, and then later Apple has an opportunity to sell them a notebook or a desktop when they're ready to move forward with an upgrade. They also mentioned potential growth of new product categories without actually mentioning the exact categories that they were talking about. I think you can probably guess where speculation lies in terms of that. We've talked about it in the past, Apple entering possibly the television market. Maybe they enter the wearable computer market. The front runner for that seems to be the iWatch, or they could have something entirely new up their sleeve. But it was good to hear Tim Cook talk a little bit and sound really excited about the products Apple has coming up, even if we might have to wait until later in the year before we actually get to see them. During the call, Tim Cook was also directly asked whether or not Apple would be shipping a larger screen iPhone, and he responded by talking about trade-offs. Basically, he felt that Apple's competitors were making some significant trade-offs in order to deliver larger screen devices, and said that that's something that Apple's not willing to do. Specifically, he cited things like resolution, color quality, white balance, reflectivity, power consumption, app compatibility, and portability. He basically said, we are not going to sacrifice those things just to ship a larger screen device. And so if you take that at face value, that really makes it seem like Apple's not ready and willing to put out a larger screen, because even the latest models from Samsung, from the reviews I've been reading, seem to indicate that especially battery life and power consumption is still one of those issues that they're struggling with. And we'll talk a little bit more about screen quality of the new Android phone versus the current generation iPhones a bit later in the show. There was big growth, actually, in iTunes, the App Store, and iCloud, and that's some pretty good news. iCloud, they said, added about 50 million users. It's now about three times the size it was just a year ago, so it's seeing phenomenal growth and now reportedly at 300 million users. And iTunes revenues were up 30%, bringing it to a record $4.1 billion in revenue for the quarter. And then finally, following the quarterly results call, Apple made an announcement that they were going to up the dividend that they are paying shareholders. Apple announced that it plans to increase its quarterly dividend to $3.05 per share. That's up from the current dividend, which is $2.65 a share. The next payout is scheduled to happen on May 16th. In addition, Apple said it has plans to increase its stock repurchasing plan. It will increase its share repurchase authorization from $10 billion to $60 billion. So a significant jump on the stock repurchasing plan. The programs are expected to use up about $100 billion of Apple's cash by 2015. That's up from about $45 billion under the prior initiatives. Most interestingly, though, rather than grabbing the money from the $145 billion war chest that Apple has, they're going to be taking some debt by issuing about $17 billion in bonds. Now, at first this might seem odd, but a big reason they're doing it is that most of that cash hoard that they have is outside the U.S., and the tax burden to bring it into the country would cause Apple to lose about one-third of its cash value to the U.S. government. That's at least according to a lot of the reports that I've been reading. And it's also more attractive now for Apple to borrow money because bond rates are actually trading near 10-year lows. So oddly, it's going to be more cost beneficial for Apple to borrow the money than to actually go out and try and bring it in from the other banks and other parts of the world that they have it in. And as we talked about on some past episodes, the idea of increasing that dividend paid out to shareholders, that was one of the number one things a lot of analysts were saying would help Apple sort of curb some of the issues they'd been having with dropping stock prices. And it certainly did seem to have a positive impact right after Apple made the announcement. So the stock has sort of stabilized and gone up a little bit since Apple said they were going to do this initiative. So overall, very positive numbers for Apple's latest quarter. And I think the next quarter, Apple is giving some pretty conservative guidance, probably because we're not expected to see a lot of new products. So Apple's not going to be selling a lot. It really seems like the back half of 2013 is going to be where Apple's going to be posting the big numbers. But we're just going to have to wait for future quarterly results calls to find out exactly what happens. Has the iPhone 5's Retina screen finally met its match in the latest Galaxy S4 phone? Over the past few years, the display testing company DisplayMate has tested, rated, and issued reports on the quality and accuracy of smartphones and other displays. In their most recent reports, they've tended to favor the iPhone's screen, saying it's the one to beat, and now it looks like Samsung may have finally caught up. You can read the full detailed report on the DisplayMate website, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, in their latest findings, they said that the iPhone 5 screen was brighter and offered better color calibration than the Galaxy 4S, but the Galaxy 4S was said to have more accurate whites and darker blacks, so it sounds like it has better contrast. Also, they said better uniformity across the display than the iPhone. The Galaxy 4S is also bigger, offers a higher resolution, and has more pixels per inch, which gives it a slight edge in those areas. In the end, the study claimed that both displays are quite good, and they say that they're comparable overall, so they called it, in essence, a draw. It's a tie between the two displays at this point. But Apple, at least in DisplayMate's mind, had always held a pretty good edge with the iPhone screens versus some of the other devices. So how did Samsung actually do it? Well, it turns out Samsung uses a pen tile display. And in the past, that's been a bit of where some of its issues came from, where it actually lost out. But basically what a pen tile display is an OLED display, and it only has 2 subpixels in each pixel rather than the standard 3 that you would have in an LCD. So in an LCD, you have red, green, and blue subpixels. In a pen tile OLED display, they have half as many. So they have half the pixels have a red and green subpixel, the other half have a green and blue subpixel, so the red and blue are always shared by the 2 adjacent pixels. And it makes the displays cheaper and easier to make, and it works well for things like photos and video images, but typically the red and blue subpixels can actually be seen in fine text and graphics, so it affects the overall quality. And I guess a key to overcoming that is resolution. You can get past some of the bad effects by jamming in more pixels. So with this latest display, they packed in more pixels and they used a different kind of shape. They used a diamond shape rather than a square or a stripe-shaped red and blue subpixel. And that was so that they could squeeze more pixels in. It also varied the subpixel size, with the blue, which has a lower efficiency, being larger and having the green pixels be a bit smaller because they're more efficient. And DisplayMate says that in the span of just 3 years, they've been able to take the OLED display technology and get it to the point where it's now challenging the performance of some of the best LCDs out there on the market. They also noted that the biggest challenge at this point for OLED displays is going to be matching the power efficiency of LEDs. But they also said that overall the technology is gaining ground. And according to the report, LCDs apparently still have some tricks up their sleeves, so that may help Apple maintain the edge if they're going to continue to use LCD versus OLED. They say that increasing the resolution and pixels per inch is going to be key to that. There's also the newer IGZO technology, and that has more advanced metal oxide backplanes, which can significantly increase and improve efficiency and performance. And there's something called quantum dots, which will allow for a broader color gamut, and allow them to provide more accurate color and image contrast, especially in bright light situations. So when you're reading outside and in sunlight and things like that, that can help. Finally, the study does note that both technologies can strive to provide better color management and color calibration, basically using technology to dynamically adjust things like color gamut and the intensities of scale for the displays to compensate for outside influences that may impact display quality, things like the reflection and glare and various issues caused by ambient lighting conditions. They say they could use technology to improve those sorts of things, and that will improve the overall qualities of the displays. So we'll have to see who moves faster, but it sounds like the OLED and Pentile display technologies are starting to catch up with what Apple has currently on the market. So what should we expect Apple to do when they update the display in the iPhone 5S? Well, as noted earlier, Tim Cook said in the conference call that they wouldn't be updating to a larger screen size unless they could do it without compromise. So I wouldn't expect a new screen this year. That being said, Jefferies analyst Peter Misick said that Cook's comment might have been a ploy to keep us from skipping the iPhone 5S just to wait for a new iPhone 6. Misick claims that Apple has worked out a way to build a larger display into the iPhone 6 without some of the trade-offs that Cook commented on, and he expects that that iPhone will be here in June of 2014. I don't know about you, but I'm not going to be waiting. That's a whole nother year. I'm probably going to be very happy to have whatever technology and whatever updates Apple delivers in the iPhone 5S. And then if they do a larger screen iPhone, an iPhone 6 the following year, I'm sure I'll be clamoring to get that one as well. So what actually is the latest roundup of updates expected for the iPhone 5S? Well, according to everything I've been reading, we can possibly expect some new color options. I'm not putting a lot of weight on that one. It'll be interesting. We have heard some rumors that Apple's playing around with colors. Mostly that's been reported on, though, for the new low-cost iPhone, not the iPhone 5S, but that's floating around out there. An upgraded processor, I think that's almost a given. I do think, though, it's likely to be a modified version of the A6 processor, some tweaks to that. Some people are saying it could be an A7, but I just don't feel that Apple's going to be ready to start delivering those processors, at least not until 2014. We can expect a better camera, probably something in the 8-megapixel, possibly 12-megapixel range. No matter what, I think it's going to have updated processing and optics, so it will be an improvement. Probably improving things like low light qualities, you know, the quality of the image in low light situations. And then there's that rumor that there will be fingerprint scanning technology built into the home button. I'm going to say maybe on that one. It may be something that's used to enable a new payment system. That's another rumor that's floating around out there, that iOS 7 will have some sort of mobile payment system that's built in, possibly leveraging Apple's Passbook technology and Passbook services. I think if they do that, they're also going to combine in some form of Apple's Easy Pay technology. That's the stuff they use in their retail stores that lets you go in and, using your iPhone, actually scan and pay for your products and then just leave the store, all without having to interact with a salesperson. And that's amazing technology. Be great to see that make its way into broader use in retail. I'm not so sure that'll happen this year, but it could, and I guess we'll find out more in the coming months. Specifically, when we might find out more would be at the Worldwide Developers Conference. Apple is going to hold that on June 10th, and tickets went on sale this past week. And they were probably without a doubt, the hottest tickets in technology. This year, Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference tickets sold out in a record, get this, 2 minutes. 2 minutes. So if you were not online and, I guess, pressing buttons fast and furiously, you were probably out of luck. I think at this time, it's practically become a joke, and I think it's something that most developers aren't finding very funny. As a matter of fact, there was quite a bit of backlash on Twitter not long after the tickets went on sale. You know, one of the key features of WWDC is that developers have direct and hands-on access to Apple engineers and experts. And for that to work, Apple needs to control the size of the event, which ultimately means they have this limited access. I think the current limit is somewhere around 5,000 developers from what I've been reading. But the trouble is that the more and more people that get into Apple's development program, it's not that costly. It costs $100 to join the various developer programs, $100 for OS X, $100 for iOS. There are casual developers, there's would-be developers in the program, and even non-developers. And all of these people are competing with a lot of the serious developers to attend the event. It's almost become this hot tech geeky event that people just want to go to because they can. And I think that's leading to some of the problems. And add to that that they've often had technical issues where the site goes down, you can't get in, you can't get logged in, and that's added a lot to the aggravation. With that many people trying to access the system all at once, you know, you can almost, it's almost an inevitability that it's going to go down, and many miss that little window of opportunity. And as it gets narrower and narrower, just a couple minutes, it's almost impossible for a lot of developers to get the ticket that they want to WWDC. So some developers have even resorted to crafting these elaborate scripts to help monitor when tickets go on sale, to notify them, and even aid in the process of trying to grab a seat for the event. There is no doubt at this point that Apple has a problem, and even they seem to recognize it. After the sellout, Apple was reportedly reaching out to some developers who tried to get tickets but couldn't. They contacted them by phone representatives, and they told the developers that they saw they were trying to purchase tickets but couldn't, and let them know that they had reserved a ticket in their name and would be sending them instructions on how to pay and how to receive their tickets. It's not really clear on which developers or how many of developers kind of got the special treatment, but Apple also did, in addition to doing that, announce that they would have a number of alternate opportunities for developers who couldn't get in. They posted a thing on their website letting them know that the WWDC videos would be available during the conference. That's quicker than they've got them up in the past. In the past, they came out like a day or possibly a week or even a month after the conference. And then they also said via their website that in the fall, they would offer developer tech talks in select cities worldwide. This is something they've done in the past, but basically little mini WWDC talks taken on tour to different cities. They didn't announce specifically where they would have them this year, but in the past, they've done it in places like New York, Seattle, Austin, Berlin, Rome, London, Beijing, Seoul, and Sao Paulo. So if you're in those regions, you might keep an eye on Apple's website, especially if you couldn't get into WWDC to see if you could take advantage of that. And I think it's probably not surprising to hear that if Apple wants some advice on how they might fix WWDC, there's plenty of ideas floating around the interwebs and Twitter. There are ideas, everything from increasing the size of the show. I don't think that would be particularly effective because it would reduce developers' access to Apple engineers, and I think that's the whole point of it. Ideas about raising the ticket price from $1,600, which is already pretty extravagant, and that actually could make it kind of unaffordable for many of the smaller developers to actually go to the show, so I'm not so sure that's a great idea. There is using a ticket lottery system. To me, this seems the most fair, but could block out certain key developers because it's just going to be random. So certain key teams and developers might not be able to get in. Weighted access to tickets based on some sort of measure, maybe seniority. So the longer you've been a developer, the more likely you are to get a ticket. The popularity of your application based on app downloads or sales, that could get a little bit... What's a good way to put that? It could get a little bit ugly. I think you probably don't want to base tickets on some sort of arbitrary popularity contest, and that seems like a system that could get gained pretty easily. And there's also been talk of some way of having like a test or something to validate that an attendee is actually a developer. And that is something that I think would be a concern. I have a feeling there's a lot of people who get in who aren't really developers, who are would-be wannabe developers, or just there because it's the hottest ticket in town, apparently. And if you are going to be in town, there are a group of folks trying to turn what is a negative into more of a positive opportunity, and that's the folks over at Appsterdam. They announced something they're calling Alt-WWDC. They have a website set up. I'll have a link in the show notes at mattcast.com, but basically they're offering up a free alternative conference that will run alongside WWDC, and it's actually taking place just down the street at the San Francisco State downtown campus. The conference is a first-come, first-serve basis, and you can RSVP through the Alt-WWDC website. The event will not have the direct access to Apple engineers and Apple-developed courses, but it is going to feature talks and food and co-working and mingling opportunities with other developers. And they actually have a pretty impressive lineup of speakers already set up on the website. Speakers like Mike Lee, Victor Agreda Jr., Brett Terpstra, Brett Simmons, Sal Mora, and a bunch of others. You can get details, as I mentioned, over on the website. And they're even going to have a breakfast on the day of the keynote for those of folks who actually couldn't get into the keynote. So it sounds like another great opportunity for developers to get together and collaborate and learn and share ideas. So hopefully that's something that continues and continues to grow and expand right alongside WWDC, because I think it sounds like a very great companion event, especially if Apple's going to continue to have these issues where not everybody who wants to go and get in can actually get in. And I think the folks at Appsterdam are great folks to be running that. They're really smart people, and they've done a great job with the whole Appsterdam thing, and it's nice to see them extending and growing that initiative as well. So a little bit of frustration this week for people trying to sign up for WWDC, but ultimately it should end up being another great event, and it's good to see such a vibrant and aggressive, excited, I guess is the term we want to use, excited developer community. That can only mean good things for us as users and beneficiaries of the software and the great things that all these great developers put together. So if you're going to WWDC, have a great time, and I hope you get a lot out of it. The quarterly results call revealed that Apple's Mac sales were down for the quarter just slightly, but DigiTimes is reporting that their supply chain checks indicate that the next quarter might see an actual increase in the number of MacBooks shipped. They say possibly up to a 10% increase for the second quarter. Since the first quarter sales were weak, this might not actually mean much, and year-over-year shipments are still expected to be down overall. A product refresh could possibly help that, but even Apple recognizes that they will see continued slowing notebook sales as many people supplement or even replace Mac purchases with things like iPads. One thing that could help juice Apple's MacBook sales would be the announcement of a new product. And if the latest rumors surrounding WWDC are true, I think DigiTimes could find that their numbers are even a bit conservative. KGI securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo has been at it again with his predictions. This time around, he's focusing on the Mac, specifically on the MacBook Pros. Ming-Chi claims that Apple may be set to announce new MacBook Pro and even MacBook Air lines based on Intel's latest Haswell processors at WWDC in June. Beyond the updated specs for the processor, I don't see any major design changes in the lineup, but still, a bump in processor and some other spec upgrades could help motivate some buyers into picking up a new Mac notebook, and that could be good for Apple's next quarter results numbers. Another thing that could help is Apple not discontinuing the non-Retina versions of the MacBook Pro. Ming-Chi Kuo notes that unit has been particularly popular among consumers, and he has gone back on an earlier report where he said Apple would discontinue that model. So that's expected to get an update as well. While the announcement of the new notebooks may happen during WWDC, the analyst says that not all of the updated models will be shipping immediately. Quo thinks that production constraints could slow the release of the updated Retina models, but that the non-Retina version could start shipping soon after WWDC. Along with the update to the MacBook Pro lines, the MacBook Airs should also get an update with new processors and new specs, but one new spec that's not going to be in there that could disappoint some people is a Retina display. It's not expected to get that bump in this round. That is a bit of mixed news because it means that those who had wanted a higher resolution display in the Ultra Portable are going to have to wait a bit longer, but it also means that those new units should also be available shortly after WWDC, should they be announced. One thing that is expected to be announced, or actually two things that are expected to be announced at WWDC, would be the next versions of Apple's operating systems, both on iOS and on Mac OS X. So what's coming in iOS 7 and Mac OS X 10.9? Well, I already told you that on the design side of iOS, the rumors are that Johnny Ive has been going on a skeuomorphic killing spree. Most of the details this week are coming from Mark Grumman over at 9to5 Mac and his sources. iOS 7 is supposedly codenamed Innsbruck, and the rumors are to expect the heavier textures, the skeuomorphic themes, and even the heavy gradients and shadows to be a thing of the past. The key word here, I think, is flat, with some claiming that the new UI will be very Windows Phone-like. I'm also thinking very much like Google's new Google Now interface, which incidentally was released for the iPhone this week. If you have the Google app on your iPhone or if you want to download it, you can take a look at Google Now and actually see what I mean. But this whole flat interface thing, something that was sort of pioneered almost with Microsoft and their Metro interface, actually even earlier than that, I think you can go back to, a little bit to the Microsoft Zune interface and see what was going on. But that seems to be the direction that most are saying Apple is, and Johnny Ive is moving in. I'm sure they're going to put their own Apple flavor and spin on it, and it's going to be elegant and beautiful. But if you are a fan of the skeuomorphic style designs, it sounds like those things are going to become more and more of a rarity. As for specifics, they say that there's going to be an all-new icon set for Apple's native applications, that we can expect newly designed toolbars, tab bars, and other fundamental interface features across the entire system. They also say that the software will reportedly have a new polarizing filter to help decrease the viewing angles for onlookers or people who might be looking over your shoulder to try and get a peek at your screen. I find that one a little bit interesting. I'm not sure if they mean they're going to do that at the software level or if there's going to be a combination of software and hardware. It also seems like something that they wouldn't do when very often displays are rated on how their off-angle viewing is. So I guess if you could do it in software and kind of turn it on or off, that would be very, very interesting. There's also rumors of a bunch of features that may or may not make it into this final build, things like more glanceable information and system option panels, but it sounds like Apple's just playing around with a couple of those things, and they might not end up being in the shipping product. I wouldn't expect some of those more test-level features to be shown off at WWDC either. This might not be a feature that makes its way into iOS 7, but Reddit had an interesting Q&A with the Swipe vice president, Aaron Sheedy, and during that, he revealed that they have at least talked with Apple about licensing the Swipe technology. For those who don't know, Swipe is a gesture typing technology that's popular on non-Apple devices, and Swipe is owned by Nuance. Apple uses Nuance technology in their dictation features, also for Siri, so it's very probable, or it makes a lot of sense, that Apple would be talking to Nuance companies about different technologies that they can roll into iOS. Swipe is pretty cool because it allows you on mobile keyboards especially to type very quickly. You basically slide your fingers over the keys, toward the letters that you want to use to spell out a word, so you don't have to lift your fingers up. It does make typing, and I've played around with it, I think it does make typing on specifically the iPhone or mobile phone, smartphone keyboards much quicker, and it has some predictive technologies in it to kind of figure out the thing that you're trying to basically slide out. I almost wanted to say type out, but you don't lift your finger from your screen. If you've ever used one of these keyboards, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. 9to5 Mac is also reporting that their sources are telling them that Apple is looking to more deeply embed Siri and iOS Maps into your car's dashboard. They say that Apple has been working aggressively to partner with automakers and that they want to be able to plug an iPhone into a car and have an optimized, redesigned version of the Apple Maps appear on the car's built-in display. That would be instead of it using a proprietary GPS system. Once that's enabled, you would use Siri then to be able to control and use many of the controls for mapping functionality and various iOS functions. And Apple has been consistently trying to push their way into that whole in-dash mobile car experience, and they haven't really made a lot of headway. If you remember, they had the whole Siri's eyes-free technology, but we haven't really seen that implemented by too many auto manufacturers. So maybe this is a move and a ploy to sort of change that. For OS X, again, we turn to 9to5 Mac's Mark Grumman. He has been a fairly reliable source in the past, and his little birdies tell him that Apple will focus in OS X more on power user features, at least for 10.9. This sounds like really good news to me. We're hearing about some goodies in his report, including things like Finder enhancements, adding things like tags and tabbed browsing modes. There's also reportedly some updates happening to the Safari engine that will improve things like page load times, speed, and efficiency. The ability to keep a different space or a full screen app open in a second monitor in multiple monitor setups. Oh, please, 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 I hope that's in there. This is something that is really annoying. If you've ever had a multiple monitor setup, so you have two monitors and you use the full screen mode, you know that you have one whole monitor that goes completely black. It's unusable, and that just seems ridiculous to me. I'd love to be able to have an app open full screen on one monitor and still use the other monitor for some other thing. Why that hasn't already been enabled is beyond me, but if that's in OS 10.9, that's worth the upgrade price alone. On the UI side, their sources say that there will be some enhancements and refining, but we probably shouldn't expect a whole lot of eye candy. A good thing, actually, in my book. I like Apple focusing on nice enhancements. I do wonder if we'll see some of Ive's influence in the flatter designs of Apple's built-in apps. Things like Contacts, Calendars, Notes, Reminders may be a little bit too soon, though, to kind of show those things off, or you know, he hasn't been working on this stuff very, very long. And if they've been focusing on iOS 7, then those changes may not be making their way back into OS 10. But we'll have to see. Maybe we'll find out a little bit more at WWDC. And while the iOS influence in macOS 10 10.8 Mountain Lion was mostly about visual things, things like the apps, the notifications, we expect that in 10.9, the influences are going to be a little bit more subtle. Their sources are claiming that Apple might include a new multitask system similar to iOS's with a quick application switcher. This would include the ability to background or pause apps that are in the background to free up additional resources, and that could be good news, especially if they're able to leverage the technology to do things like optimize the battery life in Apple's notebook lineup. And it is expected that both OS X 10.9 and iOS 7 will be previewed at WWDC in June, so we might not have to wait too long to at least get a glimpse at the new versions of the operating system. For the past few years, at least, the iPad has sort of stood alone in the tablet market space, but it looks like that tide may finally be turning, at least according to Strategy Analytics' latest numbers on tablet shipments. They are in, and they show that volume is up for Android and Windows, taking some shipment market share away from Apple. It's important to note, as we're talking about these numbers, that these are for worldwide shipments of tablets and not sales to consumers. Apple has reportedly shipped 19.5 million tablets in the first quarter of the year, an increase of 7.5 million units year over year. Android tablet shipments also rose 11.2 million units in the same period, up to 17.6 million, and Windows came into the market with 3 million units. Percentage-wise, that means that Apple devices account for about 48.2% of all global tablet shipments. That's actually down 14.9% from 63.1% share last year. Android shipments, on the other hand, accounted for 43.4% for the quarter, with Windows garnering 7.4% of first quarter 2013 shipments. Again, this really doesn't indicate too much other than the fact that Apple is shipping tablets at a lower rate than its competitors, something that would happen naturally if you have a mature product line, and Apple definitely does. Apple also didn't have any iPad updates this quarter, so that could be factoring into the numbers. Apple's market share gains in mobile phones, though, seem to be slowing as well. The latest World Mobile Phone Tracker data from IDC showed that Apple's worldwide share of the mobile phone market grew just 6.6% year over year. This is the overall phone market, not just smartphones. That puts Apple at about an 8.9% share and has them in third place behind Nokia, who has 14.8%, and Samsung sitting at the top with 27.5%. If you narrow the view just a little bit and turn your attention to just smartphones and just the U.S., Apple does fare a little bit better against Samsung. The latest ComScore numbers show that Apple has a 38.9% share of the U.S. smartphone market. That's versus Samsung's share with just 21.3%. Either way you slice up the data, though, it does seem to have an overall indication that Apple could be struggling with slowing iPhone sales, especially in price-sensitive and developing markets. That's likely one reason we've been seeing Apple up its efforts in those areas to promote iPhone sales with things like payment plans and buyback programs. They most recently did that in India, and they had very good results. It also could be a big reason why we're hearing so many rumors about Apple at least exploring the idea of a low-cost iPhone. It's definitely not all doom and gloom for iPhone sales, though. At least one analyst thinks that long-term, the iPhone may eventually beat out Android. The Yankee Group recently conducted a survey among buyers and tents regarding upcoming smartphone purchases, and they found that three times as many Android phone owners said they would be switching to an iPhone versus the other way around, with iPhone owners saying they plan to switch to Android. Turning to the actual numbers, they say that 6% of iPhone owners who were surveyed said that they were going to move to an Android device, with 18% of Android owners saying that they would be switching to an iPhone. If the study holds true, that could be good news for Apple, because Apple owners tend to be more sticky. Once they're in the platform, they seem to not leave as readily. The switch would be gradual, though. The study predicts that it will take until 2016 before Apple can surpass Android's U.S. smartphone market share. And then finally in the news for this week, some good news for iTunes, at least when it comes to purchasing or renting video content. NPD Group has numbers that show iTunes is the preferred platform of choice when it comes to buying and renting movies and TV shows. Interestingly, Xbox Live was the next nearest competitor, followed by Amazon Instant Video. In 2012, NPD said that iTunes sold 67% of electronically distributed TV content versus just 14% for Xbox Live, so quite a large margin when it comes to television content. There were similar numbers for full-length movie downloads, with Apple getting 45% of video-on-demand movie downloads versus just 18% for the next closest competitor, which in this case was Amazon Instant Video. One thing to note about this study is that it did just focus on downloaded content. It did not include demand for streaming services like Netflix or Redbox Instant Video. There have been some other studies that do include streaming services versus Apple's video content download services, and in those cases, Apple ends up with about 5% share. I think this is a big reason why we continue to hear rumors of Apple eventually wanting iTunes to have a streaming video and TV service. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's GoToMeeting by Citrix. You know, meetings are essential to the way we work. It's an opportunity we have to share ideas, to come together to solve problems, and to help develop creative solutions. But if your team is spread out, you're in different locations, it can be pretty difficult to get everybody together in one place to get the job done. That is, unless you have GoToMeeting with HD Faces. It's a powerful and simple way to meet and collaborate online. I've had GoToMeeting actually for a few years now, and after having access to it, I cannot imagine running my business without it. As a web developer, I have clients who rely on me to be their technology guy. They hire me to handle all of the technical stuff when it comes to their website, and very often they are not the tech-savvy person at their company. So when I need to get together with them for an online meeting, I need some sort of solution that is really simple and easy to use, and GoToMeeting provides me with that solution. I send out an email and literally tell them to click on a link. That's all they have to do. They click on the link, and within minutes, we're connected and we're collaborating. They can see me, I can see them, and we're able to dive in and get things done. And that's really critical and important. And when I need to do something more technical, I need to show them something specifically that I've been working on, I can easily share my screen, I can share my documents with them, and they can see exactly what I'm talking about right there on their own screen. And that avoids any confusion or miscommunication, and ultimately that saves me time and money. Plus, they have apps for your iPad, your iPhone, even your Android devices. So if you're mobile, you can meet anytime and almost anywhere with ease. You can even host meetings from your iPad. It is a really great platform, and I think it's something you really need to try. So if you'd like to check out GoToMeeting, you can use it free for 30 days by taking advantage of my special offer. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. That's GoToMeeting.com and enter the code MACCAST. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And a big thank you to GoToMeeting and Citrix for their support of the MACCAST. There was an odd bug that hit iMessage this week, or that was revealed regarding iMessage this week, and I actually haven't run into this, but maybe you have. It first showed up on a Twitter post, but it looks like some folks are noticing that their iMessages are being prematurely truncated. So you're entering a text and it's getting cut off at the last word. Basically, what seems to be happening is that certain phrases, the last word gets dropped off after the message is sent. So both on your screen and on the screen of the person you're sending the message to, that last word just isn't there. And when this bug was discovered, it seemed that there would be certain phrases that kind of triggered the effect. As a matter of fact, one of the phrases was, "I could be the next Obama," with the word Obama getting cut off. But don't worry, though, it's not some sort of conservative Apple iMessage developer making a kind of covert political statement. What seems to be happening is it's more related to the length of the phrase versus the actual content. This was revealed by some testing done by Jackie Chang over at Ars Technica. What seems to be going on is that the message text is wrapping just the last word of a specific phrase, but when it gets displayed in the message's chat bubble, that chat bubble isn't expanding to reveal the last word that you typed. And so to you and to the other person reading the message, it looks like it's just dropped the word or it's completely cut off. So with all the publicity this last week for this bug, I'm pretty certain that Apple would be aware of the issue, and hopefully they have plans to fix it in the next iOS update. I need to make a correction to something that I mentioned on the MacCast a couple episodes ago. In episode 440, I mentioned that you could not use Carbon Copy Cloner to create a clone of the hidden partition that's in Mac OS X, the hidden recovery partition. Well, it turns out that despite what I said in that episode, it looks like Carbon Copy Cloner can clone and create the hidden OS X recovery partition. Several of you, Ian, Bill, Doug, and a few others, emailed me to point out that the app does have this ability. As a matter of fact, in Ian's email, he said that I'm a Carbon Copy Cloner user, and I wanted to fill you in on some hidden features of the application that I think you've missed. Using the Disk Center section, and you can find that under the Window menu or by using Command 2 as the shortcut on your keyboard if you're a Carbon Copy Cloner user, he said, under the Disk Center section, it is possible to both create a recovery partition on a disk and also to non-destructively enable File Vault. I've used both these options and I am very impressed. So it does sound like they've added some significant functionality to Carbon Copy Cloner that I wasn't aware of. I haven't used it in a few years because I'm a super duper user, and Carbon Copy Cloner used to be free, but it's now a paid application. It's just $40, $39.95 US, I believe. So sounds like if they've added these significant updates, it's probably well worth the price. It was always a great application, and it was worth $40 as it was before, but I guess I missed this one, and my apologies to anybody who I might have confused, especially if you're a Carbon Copy Cloner owner, and also my apologies to Bombic for missing that feature update. If you want to see the rest of the features that are in Carbon Copy Cloner, you can get details on their website, bombic.com. That's bombic.com. If you want to check it out, and I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. Another bit of feedback that I received from a question on a prior episode came from your responses to a question I had from Brad. He wanted to know how he could set the default column widths in the Finder and get them to stick. He was having trouble getting them to stick on certain windows, and I offered up a couple different suggestions for setting those defaults. Well, it turns out a bunch of you had some ideas and some suggestions, as well as this suggestion that actually came from Brad himself.
Hey, Adam. Brad from West Michigan. Hey, thank you for your help in response to the question I had regarding my column view situation. Unless I missed it, I think I, in your comments, I think I figured out another way to do what I wanted to do. Instead of, you know, when I stretch the columns to the right and adjust them so that they're the width that I want them at, I found out that if you hold the Option key down while you're stretching those columns, that forces Finder to remember the width of the columns as well. So I just wanted to throw that out there too. It was something that I ended up Googling on after I sent you the question. And I found some information on that, and it works splendidly. It, you know, if you hold the Option, you have to have the Option key held down, click on the bottom of the column divider, you know, where you drag it to where you want it to go, and then release the Option key, and that will actually allow Finder to memorize the width of the columns for every window that you open, which is kind of something that I was looking to do. So I just wanted to let you know about that one too. Thanks again, Adam. Take it easy. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Brad. I appreciate you following up on your own question. That's always really cool when someone's able to do that. And I'm glad that your little trick worked out for you. And hopefully that helps some others in the MacCast community. And it just adds to the number of ways that we can do this sort of stuff. Another thing that I received, or another email I received, came from Larry, who pointed out an application that you could use to achieve what you wanted as well. It's called Extra Finder. Now, I haven't tried it myself, but he says it allowed him to set the default column widths. It's basically a tweak to the OS X Finder, and it adds a bunch of really cool features that a lot of people have asked for. So I'm not exactly sure how it's doing it, but you can add features like tabs, dual panels, and windows. It gives you the ability to make a symbolic link right from inside the Finder. You can have light text on a dark background, so if you want to have a little higher contrast on a window, it allows you to display the folder item counts and list view, and has a bunch of other tweaks and enhancements to the Finder. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com if you want to check out the full list. But it looks like something, if it works as well as Larry says, that is worth checking out. And since we're talking about applications that can kind of give you functionality beyond what the Finder offers, I'm actually going to put in a recommendation for Pathfinder, which is a Finder alternative, an application you'll use in lieu of the Finder that offers a lot of advanced features and functionality, doing stuff way beyond what the built-in Finder can do. And I've actually been a Pathfinder fan for years, and I'm a big fan of the developer Cocotec. And Cocotec was a longtime sponsor of the MacCast. So check out Pathfinder over at Cocotec.com, and I'll have a link to ExtraFinder in the show notes. And thank you, Larry, for actually pointing out ExtraFinder. That's another one that I'm going to have to go check out. Next up, I have JP, who wants to use his iPad as a way to pull images off of his digital camera in the field. He uses Apple's Camera Connection Kit, but seems to be having a slight issue with PhotoStream.
Hey, Adam, this is JP Erickson calling you from Los Angeles. Just moved out here, but I digress. I'm so excited to hear about the new iPhoto update, and I started poking around in it. I'm hoping to have a storage issue on my iPad resolved. Basically, what was going on is I was using the camera connector kit and plugging in, you know, my SD card from my digital camera, and was hoping that I could split my JPEG and RAW images so that both wouldn't be imported into the photo stream. Sadly, it seems like that is still an issue. I know if I use my computer, I can, of course, split them and then just send the JPEGs to the stream, but I was hoping to be able to kind of be on the go and be able to keep the photo stream looking good, but again, not flooded with these huge raw images. Just curious if you guys have found a workaround or if there's something that can be done, again, using the iPad, just because I can't possibly fit all the raw images up on that stream. Again, thanks, Adam. Appreciate it. Love to hear back from you.
Hey, JP. Well, welcome to California. Let me, probably not the first to say that, but let me say that to you. And thanks for the question. I had to do a little digging on this one, and it does seem to be an issue when you import via the Camera Connection Kit, because your images go into the camera roll on your device, meaning that if you have PhotoStream enabled, it's going to automatically start to upload those. So the way to get around this would be to turn off PhotoStream, but that's not sounding like what you want to do. You actually want to have your JPEG images in there and just not have the raw images go up. So the first thought that I had was, well, maybe you could turn off PhotoStream temporarily while you do the import, then move your images from the camera roll into, say, the photo application, into the library in there, and then just simply remove the raw images from the camera roll and then turn PhotoStream back on. But when I tried this, it didn't really seem to work for me. I tried going into the photo application, selecting the camera roll album, and then selecting the images and adding them to another album, say an album called Raw Images. That worked fine. So I was able to import them with PhotoStream turned off, move them into an album inside the Photos application. But what happened was when I went back to the camera roll and I tried to delete the images that I had just put into the Photos app, it warned me that it was going to delete the images everywhere. And sure enough, when I said, okay, go ahead and delete the image from the camera roll, it also deleted it from the album. So that sort of defeated the purpose. So I did a little more digging, and I found one workaround on Apple's discussion forums. I'll have a link in the show notes at MacCast.com if you want to read the full thread. But basically, they said what you can do, and I haven't had a chance to really test this, so I'm taking a little bit on faith. But they said that you could import your JPEG and RAW images using the Camera Connection Kit, and then open the imported album in iPhoto on the iPad. So I guess you'd have to have iPhoto on the iPad for this to work. And then you can choose to copy them at that point to the camera roll. And then you go back into the Photos application and delete all of the photos that you all of the photos in your imported album. That would be the album that is set up automatically when you import from the Camera Connection Kit. It will say that it's going to delete them everywhere, and it really doesn't, because I guess it leaves the JPEGs in the camera roll, at least according to this blog post. So the result is that you'll only have your JPEGs in your camera roll, and that the raw images themselves get deleted. Now, again, I have not tested this, so if you do, make sure that you back up everything first, and if it does work for you, let me know if that works out. And then the other option that I thought about is I have a great little device. It's called an AirStash. It's about $100, $130 US, and it looks like kind of an oversized USB drive or thumb drive, like a USB stick. But what you can do is you can take an SD card and you can pop it into the end of the AirStash, and it, in essence, acts like a wireless, almost like a wireless SD card reader, or more appropriately, it acts like a file server, because what it actually will do is set up a web DAV server that you can connect to directly from your iOS device over ad hoc or local Wi-Fi. And so what you do is you connect via wireless to the little AirStash device with your SD card in there, and they have an iPad app that lets you browse the SD card directly. And at that point, you could simply go into the DCIM folder, your images folder, and copy over the JPEGs to the camera roll, leaving the raw images behind. As a matter of fact, when I was playing around with this, the AirStash app will even convert your raw images, if you want, over to JPEG in the camera roll as you import it. So you could import just JPEGs in the camera roll, let those update your photo stream, and you would be good to go. Now, maybe that is or isn't what you want. I wasn't 100% certain. If you want to keep both the RAW and JPEG images on your device, I didn't really find a way to do that and not have both images go up into your photo stream. So maybe someone in the audience, maybe one of you knows an app or another way to accomplish what JP wants to do. If you do, shoot me an email, let me know, mattcast@gmail.com, and we'll try and follow up on a future episode. And then finally, in the show for this week, Dave asked me, do I have to manually disconnect my Thunderbolt drive every time I want to unplug it or disconnect it from my Mac to avoid that error message that pops up that says, I didn't unmount my drive before disconnecting it? He added that for PCs, this isn't an issue, and he's not sure whether or not or why it is an issue for Macs. And Dave, I'll tell you, the reason it's not an issue on the PC is simply that PCs hide the option in the system tray. If you go into the system tray for your devices, you can actually get a little pop-up. I think you have to right-click on something, and it'll say safely remove hardware. I believe that's what it says under the option. But PCs, I guess, or Windows systems just assume that at any point you might disconnect an external drive. And so they handle things a little bit differently. It, in essence, comes down to write caching. And on Windows, Windows disables write caching on external drives by default. On Macs and Linux, they use write caching on drives, including external volumes, so ejecting a volume first becomes the safest way to remove that drive to help avoid corruption. The trouble comes into play when you actually disconnect a drive while it's in the middle of a read-write operation. If you disconnect it when it's just sitting there idle, it really wouldn't matter whether or not you ejected or unmounted the drive before you actually disconnected. So on the Mac, if you're sure that your drive is not doing any reading or writing, if you're not reading or writing to the drive, it's perfectly fine to simply disconnect it. You'll still get the error message, but it's really not going to harm anything. Now, that said, I really don't recommend doing that because how do you know whether or not your drive is in the middle of a read-write operation? Maybe it has a light on it, maybe it doesn't, but really, are you going to want to take that risk? We used to have this kind of running joke that real men don't eject their external volumes first. You just rip the cord out. But I really wouldn't want to risk it. But if you're willing to risk it, you will probably be annoyed by that pop-up message. And I do not know a way to make that go away permanently. I don't know a way to disable that error message that says you didn't safely eject or disconnect your drive. And I will also mention that even on Windows, it hides that safely remove hardware option in the taskbar, but I would still recommend that you use it manually, ejecting your drive first before you disconnect it on Windows. It's just the safest way to do it to avoid any corruption that might happen if you disconnect that drive while it's in the middle of a read or a write operation. And on the Mac side, there is an application that might help you out depending upon when and how you need to disconnect your external drives. If it's the kind of thing where you're shutting down your Mac, you're putting it to sleep, so you maybe it's a notebook or a MacBook or MacBook Pro, and you need to just take it on the road, there is a cool little application called Jettison that will auto-eject your volumes when you put your Mac to sleep. So when you close the lid, it'll automatically go through and safely eject all of your external volumes, and then you can disconnect them so that when you get where you're going and you open the screen back up, you're not bombarded by that error message that said, hey, you didn't disconnect your drive, you're going to get corruption, or you could get to corruption. I forget the specific phrasing on that error message, but there's a couple ideas, and maybe some of you have some additional ideas for how to get around the disconnecting the drive error message. And if you do, let us know, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make text expander, PDF pen, disc label, PDF pen for the iPhone and the iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can get information on all of their software, as well as free trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. I want you to try out GoToMeeting free for 30 days. You just have to visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, MacBook, Samsung Galaxy S, or other smartphone is worth over at gazelle.com. Squarespace is a beautiful and intuitive website publishing platform. It allows anyone to easily create a professional web page, blog, or online store all on a single platform. You can try it free, no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up now. And when you decide to purchase your new account, you can get 10% off using the offer code MACCAST4. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And ShareFile by Citrix. Take all of the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email attachments and FTP with ShareFile. You can try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. If you have any feedback for me, if you have a comment, you have a question, you can send email, you can send audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave voicemail on the listener hotline. That's 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemails on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need links to anything that I talked about in this show or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And then you can find me online between shows. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can also check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast. I'm on Google+ and a myriad of other places, including app.net and all your favorite social media services. Just look for MacCast, and that's pretty much what I am every place. If you don't find me under MacCast, you can try the MacCast. But 99.98% of the time, I am MacCast on whatever service. So look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.